topics, QCD, and I think that's the plan this week. So I've written here, the, let's say, so we want to talk about three light flavors of quarks, the up, down, and strange quarks. Again, we'll talk about this in terms of an approximate symmetry breaking pattern. So we have an SU3 left that rotates the UV and S quarks into each other, left-handed quark, another SU3 right that rotates the right-handed quarks, and the U1 vector, breaking to the SU3 vector across U1. And again, we won't really care about the U1 because all of the light degrees of freedom will be neutral under it. So we expect, even in the limit that the symmetry is only approximate, we expect to see a theory of the lightest particles in the theory to be described as pseudo-Goldstone bosons that I can wrap up into this matrix U, which is going to be e to the I lambda A pi A over F, where now instead of the tau, two taus that I was using before as representation matrices of the of SU2, I've gone to lambda A as the representation matrices of SU3. Okay, and if you're wondering about the difference in 2 between this formula and the SU2, it's just that last time I was using 2 tau, but tau was sigma over 2. So really the coefficient going into U was just 1 times sigma. And now I'm using 1 times lambda.
Now, most of us don't know the lambda matrices by heart the way we do the sigma matrices. But I've just written down a matrix-valued field, pi times lambda, as a way of succinctly reminding ourselves what it is. So lambda 1 is just the matrix that multiplies pi 1 in here. And it's just a sigma 1 inside of this upper triangular piece. Pi 2 is a sigma 2 in the upper triangular piece. 4 and 5 are like sigma 1 and 2, but between 1 and 3 and so on. Now, as before, we can label these more conveniently, especially the off-diagonal guys, by talking about their electromagnetic charges, right? And these should really be the upper and lower triangular should really be particle and antiparticle. So we define pi plus to be equal to 1 over root 2 times pi 1 minus I pi 2. And pi minus, same with the signs reversed. Pi plus, in the quark model, we'd say pi plus is a UD bar bounce, a UD bar composite. Pi minus is a U bar D. And then the new elements, so these, pi minus, pi plus, and pi 3 are roughly the same as the pi naught, pi plus and pi minus we were talking about in the SU2 sector. Those are the three generators that are traceless on just this subsector of the matrix, the pi 1, pi 2, and pi 3. So those correspond to the SU2 states. And then 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are new states, which physically we interpret as the K plus and K minus. Those are US bar or U bar S states. And then DS bar, well, D and S, I should write down the electromagnetic charges of each of these. So this is 2/3 minus 1/3 minus 1/3. So a DS bar bound state is neutral. That's called the neutral kaon. It's conjugate K bar. And then this pi 8. We'll come back to the pi 8. In the quark model, we would say pi 3 is a composite of UU bar minus DD bar. And pi 8 is 1 over root 3 times UU bar plus DD bar minus 2. I'd say there's a 1 over root 2 there. Sorry, and this one's a 1 over root 6. Times UU bar plus DD bar minus 2 SS bar. Now, if you just counted states in the quark model, you'd say, I have my Q left, that's a triplet. I'm going to multiply that by my Q right. It's an anti-triplet. It's the anti-fundamental representation. Well, clearly that's nine states. And in the base in the SU three group theory, that's an octet, the one we've written down, plus a singlet. The singlet state, I'm going to go ahead and call that eta naught. It's just the totally symmetric linear combination. This is not a pion. It's not a pseudo-Goldstone boson. It would have been if that U1 axial had been had actually been a symmetry, because it would have been spontaneously broken. And then eta naught, this would have been the pseudo-Goldstone of the U1 axial. Okay, but we don't have a U1 axial, so this is not a pseudo-Goldstone boson. In fact, it'll be parametrically heavier than all of these guys, but still light enough that to get a match with the real world in talking about these states, we'll need to include it. So the mass of eta naught is much greater than the mass of all the pions, kaons, etc., but not big enough to ignore. So let's talk, speaking of masses, let's talk about the symmetry breaking Lagrangian. It's going to have exactly the same form as the one we talked about last week. Yeah. What I mean is that its mass isn't set by, so the mass of all the other particles is going to be set by something like delta times the mass of a quark over f squared. Okay? So this is parametrically small when m is much less than. Well, really, when m is small, there's a reason that these quark masses are small, right? Both delta and f are sort of roughly set by the QCD scale. So if m quark, this is m pi squared. If m quark is much less than lambda QCD, then m pi squared is much less than lambda QCD. Whereas the eta naught mass is just of order lambda QCD, because it's not, so in general, all the composite states, the proton, the neutron, etc., their masses are just set by the QCD scale. So the pion masses are much less than lambda QCD in this limit. The eta naught mass squared is just of order. Sorry, I should square that. This is just of order lambda QCD squared. So that's what I mean by parametrically. Numerically, this is also heavier by about a factor of two. The fact that it's only a factor of two is why I say we'll have to take it into account. All right, so the symmetry breaking Lagrangian is just the usual one. Trace of U times the mass matrix plus its Hermitian conjugate. So I can just write that, and I'll give it the same coefficient as before. Delta over 2, where delta carries mass dimension 3. I can rewrite that as delta over 2 times the trace of U plus U dagger times M up and down. Strange. Now, I'm not going to do 3x3 matrix algebra on the board, but if you were to just add that matrix to its conjugate, trace it with the mass matrix, you could just read off the mass terms for each of the particles. Okay, so for pi 3, well, for pi plus or minus, we would get a mass. Sorry, this has a minus sign as well. We would get a mass of mass squared delta times m up plus m down over f squared. For the k plus or minus, we'd get delta times m up plus ms over f squared. For the k naught, we'll get delta times m down plus ms over f squared. Numerically, these end up being, well, after electromagnetic corrections to the pi plus mass, 139 MeV squared, 493 MeV squared, and 497.6 MeV squared. Okay, notice we can conclude a few things just by staring at these masses. First, based on the fact that the k plus is a little bit lighter than the k naught, we can conclude that m down is less than m up. And in fact, the difference, m up minus m down, sorry, nobody catch that? M down is greater than m up. M down minus m up over m down plus m up should be approximately equal to this difference, mk naught minus mk plus squared. Over the pi on mass squared. Okay, that's about 0.2. So that means that m down is about 1.5 to 2 times m up. Small comment, by the way. I mean, last lecture I gave you some rough estimates based on what delta was on the lattice, what m up plus m down was in MeV. Okay, now those are estimates that you have to be very careful defining because the up and down quark masses are running, right? There's RG evolution. Those masses have a beta function. You should think of the m up and m down as having different masses depending on what renormalization scale you work at. The main factor in that renormalization is the running from QCD. These mass ratios.
Question.
Yeah?
So the numbers on PDQ, are they for asymptotically fixed?
I don't remember, but I'm sure it's written in the PDG. that's a good question. Right. I think those are probably defined at scales of around a GeV, but I mean, they, I'm sure, say much more precisely what they're doing. And I'm not sure. Those might be at a higher mass scale. I mean, I should know because I quoted one to you yesterday, or Friday. But I actually don't remember what scale they're defined at. These ratios, though, m down over m up, most of the RG evolution, the part coming from QCD, which is the by far the largest part, cancels out of the ratios. So these are really pretty much scale-independent properties that we're reading off from the pions. Also, the ratio, the factor delta, which we had to simulate, factors out of just measuring the ratios. That's the first thing we notice. The second thing we notice is, well, the kaons are a lot heavier than the pions. So ms is much greater than m up plus m down, even. In fact, ms over m up plus m down would be approximately equal to the kaon mass squared over the pi on mass squared, which is about 12. So the ratio of these quark masses, m up to m down to ms, something like 1 to 1.5 to 2 to 30. Yeah. No, thank you. That was just a typo. So I should say, first of all, the way you can read off the quark content of an entry of this matrix and tell whether I'm being a moron or not is that just that each row corresponds to a different quark and each column to a different antiquark. So this is U ds, U bar, D bar, S bar, and indeed K bar naught is the conjugate of ds bar. It is S D bar. So thank you. Okay, so these are the off-diagonal quark masses. The off-diagonal meson masses. And there's something that I mentioned last time, that the pi plus or minus mass didn't depend, and the pi naught mass didn't depend on m up minus m down, just on m up plus m down. That might seem a little weird, because we know that m up minus m down breaks the symmetry. It breaks the vector isospin symmetry. And, right, there was an extra symmetry that was broken when these guys were different. And that's precisely a symmetry that relates the pi plus minus and the pi naught. So we really maybe should have been surprised that those masses were the same in the theory. And you see that actually that's not general. The k plus minus and the k naught, they depend, their mass splitting depends on m up minus m down. We were able to get a handle on it from there. Yeah? Remember, it's their sum times delta. So delta was approximately 300 MeV cubed. Okay? So the m up plus m down at the same, their sum is not 100 because this delta over f squared has dimensions. And in fact, it's larger than 100 MeV. So m up plus m down, if I take that estimate for s delta on the sort of GeV scale running of the quark masses, is in the neighborhood of 6 MeV. M up minus m down is in the neighborhood of 2 MeV. Part of the way it's easy to get your intuition screwed up is by not squaring the numbers when you take ratios. And we always talk about the mass, the thing with units and MeV. But what's going into these numbers is always the square of that mass. So yeah, there's no particular degeneracy between the up and the down quarks. If there were, that would be something to explain. Does that answer your question? Okay. So why does mk naught minus mk plus or minus depend on m up minus m down, or m down minus m up? And m pi naught minus m pi plus or minus, as we studied it yesterday, doesn't. There's a simple symmetry way of thinking about this. So when we talk about the isospin multiplet, So now isospin, I'll just remind you, isospin is the T3 component of this SU2 SU2 between down and up. So if I have up and down, I say that up has isospin 1/2, and down has isospin minus 1/2. The mass difference is a delta I equals 1. It's a difference between things that differ in isospin by 1 unit. If you look at the pi naught, pi plus or minus, our isospin multiple, it looks like this, where this, being a U d bar, has isospin plus 1, 0, minus 1. And we can really think of this mass difference as of this of m pi plus squared minus m pi naught squared as being a delta I equals 2. Okay, so even though this violates isospin, you'd need to, this is really just a statement that these pions have a quark and an anti-quark that are both up or down in them, okay? So when we talk about isospin, we say that the up quark has isospin 1/2, down quark has isospin minus 1/2, and S has isospin 0. Isospin is just a way of keeping track of this approximate symmetry between the up and the down. So because this has twice as much isospin violation, this would have to be proportional to the square, m down minus m up squared, and then by dimensional analysis, delta squared divided by something with mass dimension. There's different things that could go in here, but I'll just call it x with mass dimension 6. If you look instead at mk plus or minus minus mk naught squared, now we're comparing things that they both have one strange quark, talking about, say, US bar versus DS bar. These just change isospin by 1 unit. So this is also sort of delta isospin equals 1. And this can be proportional to delta times m down minus m up over f squared, which is exactly what we saw. Okay, so you can understand the absence of terms, and we've only worked to linear order in the masses. Right. Certainly, we could have written down a higher order term in the Lagrangian where we had, say, that trace squared. Right. And then we would have gotten something proportional to delta squared m down minus m up squared over f to the sixth. That's a term we could have written down. There's another term that we're already forced to include. Well, it does, but at a higher order. Okay? Sorry. So at first order, I'm saying at first order in the masses, it doesn't. Because I can't write down anything that's linear in the mass difference that has delta I equals 2. Right? Just because the mass difference is the only thing breaking isospin, and it has delta I equals 1. I would have to go to second order, which means more powers of mass in the denominator and more suppression by this small mass difference. So one thing I could have written down is this thing suppressed by high powers of F. That would come in at higher order Now I just want to mention something that happens even at first order when I look at the full matrix. Because when I evaluate the masses, in addition to m, so we have some, some m3 squared pi 3 squared plus m8 squared pi 8 squared, there's also a mixing mass term. Multiplies pi 3 pi 8. That means that pi 3, the pi minus, the thing we would have identified as pi naught, is actually not a mass eigenstate. So the mass eigenstate is really some pi 3 plus epsilon pi 8, where epsilon, the size of this mixing, is pretty small. Epsilon is of the order m up minus m down over 2ms plus m up plus m down. So this is certainly small number, less than a 10% effect. Means that really the pi naught, and in 98% of cases you can neglect this, but the pi naught really truly isn't just UU bar minus DD bar. It's that over 1 minus epsilon squared kind of correction plus epsilon times pi 8. Okay? And I won't even write down the coefficients of epsilon because you really don't need to know. But this does mean formally that you get a contribution to m pi naught squared. It looks like delta over f squared times m up plus m down minus 1/2 m up minus m down squared over 2ms minus m up minus m down. Okay, and likewise, when you look at the mass of the eta squared, where eta, well, eta still isn't a mass eigenstate, but if I just diagonalize within this matrix, I have my pi 3 plus epsilon pi 8, that's going to be pi naught. And then there's pi 8 minus epsilon pi 3, that I'm going to call eta 8. So eta 8 is, in terms of the quarks, 2ss bar minus dd bar minus uu bar all over root 6 plus some epsilon times an isospin ranking piece, pi 0. I'll call it pi 3. And this guy's mass is delta over f squared times 4ms plus m up plus m down over 3 plus 1/2 times the m up minus m down squared. Same term, 2ms minus m down minus m up. Now, why am I showing you all these mass formulas? This last term is tiny. In fact, it's so tiny, it's smaller than the electromagnetic correction we talked about last week. Which was also violating isospin by 2 units, by the way. But instead of violating isospin through the masses being different, it was proportional to the difference in charges, in electric charges, squared, morally. So that's why that can be big. I just wanted to show it in order to make this point about the symmetry structure dictating how big each effect is in a particular observable, in this case, the masses of the pions. So the fact that the up-down mass difference is seen to be a much more important factor in the kaon system where there's only one up or down type quark than in the pion system where there's two. Okay, now there's a famous relation, Galmanno-Kubo relation, between all these pion masses. It's basically coming from the fact that that pi matrix is traceless. You know that the mass of the A to eight squared plus m pi naught squared should be equal to m pi plus or minus squared plus m k plus or minus squared plus m k bar squared times a factor of 2/3. And from that, we could predict the mass of the A to eight to be 567 MeV. Okay, now I mentioned that there was this ninth particle in the quark model, and what I call the eta naught. And since the strange quark mass, so m eta naught squared can be big, where big means around 1,000 MeV, 1 GeV squared, just the same mass as the proton and the neutron, that parametrics. Okay, but the mixing mass, eta naught, eta eight, well, that relies on MS breaking SU3. In fact, it's of the same order as the kaon mass. It's of order delta times MS over F squared. So what we have, if we now try to diagonalize the eta naught, eta eight mass matrix, there's going to be some non-negligible mixing, because this is not, I mean, we have some order, just in terms of order of magnitude, order mk squared diagonal term for the eta eight, order mk squared off diagonal, and then this order m proton squared off diagonal for the eta naught. Okay, these have coefficients that I can calculate exactly in the quark model. I'm just not, in terms of the MS and that symmetry breaking model over there, I'm just not writing them down. And there's calculable numbers here. This is really just an order of magnitude that I can't estimate. And that means that the mixing will be of order mk squared over m proton squared minus mk squared. And the kaon mass getting up to 500 MeV, that's big enough that this can't be completely neglected. So in fact, there's about a 20 degree mixing angle between the eta naught and the eta eight. And the states we actually talk about, the mass eigenstates, and the only deep thing about what I'm telling you is that these are the actual mesons that we see in nature. You know, otherwise, this would be not very interesting matrix algebra, but it describes things we've seen. So I'm telling you about it. The mass eigenstates are what we call the eta and the eta prime. The eta is the lighter one. It's mostly eta 8. It's mostly the pseudo-Goldstone boson plus some epsilon contribution, some theta contribution of eta 0. And its mass is close to this 567. It's perturbed a little bit. It's actually 540. MeV, 547. The eta prime, which is mostly eta naught, with a little admixture of eta 8, sorry, its mass squared is equal to 958 MeV squared. And this is all within about 10 to 15% of the estimates that you'd get from this spontaneous symmetry breaking picture. Now, again, just this one point. So the if you've ever thought, I know when I was first learning particle physics, I thought, oh, the reason that, you know, there's these mesons, they're lighter than the proton and neutron. Why are they lighter than the proton and neutron? Maybe it's because they're built out of two quarks, one quark and antiquark. The proton and neutron are built out of three. That's completely wrong. The eta prime is built out of two quarks, and it's still just as heavy as the proton and neutron. The real way of understanding why the mesons, why these particular mesons are lighter, the pions and the kaons, is really that they're pseudo-Goldstone bosons, that there's an approximate symmetry. And if that symmetry were exact, they would be massless. So now, we're approaching a realistic theory of the pions. At least they have masses now, and there are kaons around. This is good. We can describe pretty much all of the strongly interacting states below. All of them below 900 GeV, 900 MeV. So for all this work that we've done, this is still a really unrealistic model because these pions, these kaons, you know, your cats aren't made out of them. You're not made out of them. They're not stable. So we need to talk. We still need to understand pion decay. It's the last thing that I want to talk about before turning to higher energy physics of the Standard Model. And so pion decay, at least for the pi plus and minus, happens through the weak interactions. And Philip introduced the weak interactions early in the course. I'll just remind you, reintroduce some conventions, that the Lagrangian for the weak interactions, I can write it as Ig2 times some W mu J mu alpha, where alpha runs over 1, 2, and 3. It's the SU2 index. And this J includes a sum over the lepton flavors, I equals 1, 2, and 3. L I bar, I'll write this Phillips way now, L I dagger, sigma bar mu times I tau A over 2, tau alpha over 2. L I, where these L's are SU2 doublets, contain a left-handed lepton and a neutrino. And I equals 1 corresponds to the electron-electron neutrino. 2 corresponds to the muon and the muon neutrino. And 3 corresponds to the tau and tau neutrino. So that's the leptonic part. of the weak current. It's purely chiral. The weak interactions only couple to the left-handed leptons and the left-handed quarks. For the quarks, we had a term that looked similar, except that in the mass eigenstate basis, the index algebra structure is more complicated. So I'll write down my Q dagger I sigma bar mu tau over 2 Q j, and these ijs well, the mass eigenstate basis breaks SU2, but at least for the weak so times some matrix Mij alpha. This is not conventional notation. This Mij at all. For alpha equals 3, the neutral part, you have Mij alpha as just delta ij. Okay? The neutral current of the weak interactions is just diagonal. For the plus or minus pieces, which are alpha, which are the 1 plus or minus I times 2 pieces, your M goes like the CKM matrix. Or CKM dagger. And these have some non-trivial matrix structure. So we'll understand where this comes from again when we go back to the Higgs mechanism. I know you've also talked about it in tutorial. But it's an important fact that the weak interactions have both UD bar matrix elements, these are of order G2, and US bar matrix elements, these are of order G2 times the Khabibbo angle, theta. Okay? So that's the structure at quark level of the weak interaction. For alpha equals 3. I should just call this 3. And then M1 plus or minus I2 is going to be proportional to the CKM matrix as an IJ matrix. And the only aspect of this that we'll really be using today is these two couplings, the UD bar and US bar. Now, how do we write a left-handed current for pions? Well, we can get it at leading order just using Noether's theorem to leading order. So in particular, what I want to construct is a left-handed SU3 octet current. Okay, so something that has the same lambda A index. And then I'll be able to dot this into some charge matrix, just like trace this into a charge matrix, just like I did to talk about electromagnetism in the pion sector earlier, right? Where I had a J alpha times Q alpha. This Q alpha looked like was based on the charge matrix. I guess I did this for the quarks last time. But I'll do something analogous for the pions. I'm just going to build a 3x3 matrix of currents, and then using the quark model, I can decide which linear combinations I want to couple to the weak interactions and by how much. So first we construct this octet current. And at leading order, well, this should be exactly equal to the thing we get from Emmy Noether. So here, this beta left is the generator of the SU3 left. And I can just differentiate the Lagrangian, and then each pion, what I mean by pi b depends, changes under the action of this current. Then I just use the variation of the Lagrangian. That'll give me, at leading order, f pi over 2, del mu pi a of x plus higher order. If I want to solve this higher order part exactly, in particular, this fixes the coefficient. Okay, this j left mu a has a coefficient that's just well defined based on what I mean by a left-handed rotation. To extend it, I need to all orders, I need a function. I need to build a JL out of the U fields. Okay. Just by Lorentz invariance, it'll have to have a del mu U or a del mu U dagger. I want it to be a singlet under SU3 right, an octet under SU3 left. So how do I do that? Well, under these transformations, U went to V left, U V right dagger. And so if I take del mu u times u right dagger, that has, sorry, times u dagger, that will just be an adjoint under v left. And then, so this gives me a matrix. Then to actually write it in terms of the a's, I just trace this times lambda a. Okay. And then I fix the coefficients by expanding it out into pions matching to that. So the final answer is that J left mu A is equal to minus I F pi squared over 2 times this trace. Okay, and J right would have just had the roles of the U and U dagger exchanged here, so that it was adjoint under U right, under V right, rather than an adjoint under V left. Now we can define our weak coupling matrix, which I'll call Q left A. And I'm only interested now in the charge. I want to specialize to charged currents. So this is going to just have our U bar, D bar, S bar indices, U, D, S. I'm going to write down a U D bar, let me say for the plus case, I'd have a U D bar with the coefficient V U D and V U S. And then that is actually Q minus, because it dots with, it's the thing that dots with J. With W plus. And then Q plus is equal to Q minus dagger. So my current, this was the, I wrote up there, the J current for leptons. If I want to talk about coupling leptons through the weak interactions to mesons, I'll write J mu alpha minus, say, to be the sum of the lepton pieces, L dagger I sigma bar mu. Tau plus in the SU2, which is just projecting onto the L nu piece, times, sorry, L nu bar, times Li, plus, so this is the lepton current, plus, I have my meson current, which is going to be J left mu A times Q left A, which is just really picking out the, so this is the meson, the light meson current. And this is just picking out, if you look at these two components, it's just picking out pi plus and pi minus, and sorry, pi plus and and k plus. Okay, and this really should, I'm sorry, this really should be q left plus. I just had it backwards in my notes. And q minus should be q plus dagger. So the J for the light mesons, this will look something like at leading order. Using the leading order expression that I covered up with the board here. It'll just look like f pi over 2 times del mu pi plus j minus will look like del mu pi minus times VUD star plus del mu k minus VUS star. Okay. The in which term? In this one?
Yeah.
It's coming from these derivatives. So I should write it upper to be consistent. But okay. Yeah, were you asking? So these mu's soak up, just match the J mu in the expression for J minus. Now, we talked earlier about integrating fields out at tree level, and I don't know if you've
you wrote mu alpha minus. Alpha is put to be minus, right? In the electric charge coloring, there is no alpha in.
So I guess I meant, I'm sorry. I was just being inconsistent. So here I used the minus. And then I replaced the tau alpha with the tau minus in this case. Was that the question? Was that the point you were asking about? Okay. So I can use these currents. I'm actually going to shortcut and work in the Fermi effect of Lagrangian. So sure. So working in the Fermi Lagrangian, I can just write my integrating out the W's. I can just write the Lagrangian for the weak interactions as equal to 4 times G Fermi over root 2 J mu plus J mu minus plus a neutral term. Let me just make sure that I got the coefficients right. Okay, and from that, we can then just read off that this contains terms that are going to look like, if I put in the J plus for leptons, I will have some new sigma bar mu times I, what am I doing this way? Charged lepton dagger, sigma bar mu, I nu. So this is part of the J plus electromagnetic for any I. It's going to be electrons, muons, taus, times the negative current I wrote down for the pions, F pi over 2, del mu pi minus. Vu d star plus del mu k minus vu s star times, of course, this overall factor for G Fermi over root 2. Please don't trust my factors of 2 too carefully in this part of the lecture. This constant G Fermi can be measured in purely leptonic. So I mentioned long ago that we can measure F pi from the weak decays of pions. You can see how you can do this, because now we can just read off a matrix element here for pi minus goes to L minus times a neutrino and compute the cross section. This cross section is equal to, now I want to get my coefficients right. So sorry, it's not a cross section. It's a branching rate. It's a partial width. The width for, say, pi minus goes to L minus nu is equal to the mass of the pion over 4 pi. And this is just the usual phase space and dimensionality you need for the decay. Everything else I write down will be dimensionless. Times G Fermi F pi times VUD squared. And these are just the coefficients in the Lagrangian, right? So it's no surprise that they'd appear squared in the width. Times, if you look at the total dimensionality here, this has dimension 1. G Fermi has dimension minus 2. As you can see from counting up here, each current's dimension 3. So G Fermi has to be dimension minus 2. So this whole coefficient carries mass dimension minus 2 when you square. And we have to make that up somehow. Turns out this is made up by a mass of the lepton squared. And I'll describe why in just a minute. That's the thing that you might, the only thing that you might find a little bit surprising about this matrix element at first glance is the fact that this isn't made up by the energy. Most of the time, mass dimensions and cross sections and in decay lifetimes are measured by, are made up by energy. Here it's made up by the lepton mass. And then there's a little correction term. This is just to do with the finite momentum of the outgoing particles goes into their phase space, right? Because of all the 1 over 2 e's in the integration. So First, let's take this at face value. If we measure G, we measure the pion mass. We measure G Fermi in a leptonic weak decay interaction, say the lifetime of the muon. And you approximate VUD equals 1, then you can just read off F pi. You can also, by comparing the lifetime of a pi minus to the lifetime of a kaon, read off VUD. But so there's a lot of things that you can just read off from this kind of decay rate. But I want to focus on this m lepton squared. Just give you, why does this go like m lepton squared and not energy? There's a really nice, I mean, if you just do the math inside of the spinner manipulation, you'll get this. It's not very enlightening. But this is a very physical factor. In fact, most factors that you see, even when they look very ad hoc, eventually have a physical way of understanding them. So let's imagine that we have here sitting here a pi naught. Has total angular momentum 0. It's a scalar in its rest frame just sitting there. Suddenly it decays to, sorry, not a pi naught, a pi minus, to a mu minus times a neutrino and a neutrino. These both have to be left-handed through the weak interactions, right? So the naive thing we'd want to do is it's going to shoot off an anti-neutrino. Okay, so this is really, this is, again, the Phelps, this is a new left dagger, or what I would have called a new left bar using the conventions I was using before. So this is a left-handed, the weak interaction couples to left-handed particles and to right-handed antiparticles. And remember, in the massless limit, this handedness, this helicity, is an exactly conserved quantum number. So what the weak interaction wants to produce is a muon that's left-handed, which means its spin is anti-aligned with its momentum, and a neutrino, anti-neutrino, that's right-handed. So its spin is aligned with its momentum, which means clearly the two spins are aligned with each other. So this is a J equals 1 state. I can't conserve angular momentum and decay in the way that the weak interactions want. What needs to happen is that you're actually decaying into, let's say that the neutrino was exactly massless, so its spin is an exactly conserved thing. What we need is that the muon actually has to flip its spin, and then you can get a J equals 0. So the muon spin must flip. And the matrix elements that involve a spin flip are always suppressed by, the matrix element is suppressed by the mass of the lepton over the energy. And then you square that. That gives you, instead of an E squared in the cross section, an M lepton squared. In other words, if I were to have a muon, if the rate for muon, decay to muons, is much higher by M mu over M E squared, right? So that's a factor of 10,000, 10 to the minus 4 ratio between the muon decay light, muon partial width and the electron partial width. And the physical reason for that is that the electron is approximately a relativistic particle. And so it has a very low probability of actually changing its spin. That low probability of changing its spin is what suppresses the decay rate. This actually is the beginning of a really simple understanding of all the pion lifetimes, okay? Of all the charged pion lifetimes. So sorry, all the different branching ratios. So if you look in the PDG, pi plus, I'm going to work on the pi plus now, but it's the same business. This is 99.987% of pion decays. if you go down, there's two comparably small decays. This one, electron and a neutrino, that's 10 to the minus 4. And we just understood why. It's that m electron squared over m muon squared. This guy, what does it look like? I'm just radiating, taking the old decay process, and radiating a photon off the muon. So it's also at the level of 10 to the minus 4. The way we understand that is that there's an alpha, roughly an alpha over 4 pi, suppressing it. Alpha, an e squared over 16 pi squared, with the e squared coming from that new vertex, the 16 pi squared coming from the increased phase space, for the extra phase space integral for 3 particles. And in addition, there's some sort of a log for, because this photon could be emitted at roughly at any energy scale, and there's a log associated with that, but it's of order m pi over m mu, which is a pretty small number. This turns out to be 2 10 to the minus 4, and you can get the order of magnitude scaling just from this. There's also the next decay mode down is e plus nu gamma. You can apply the same scaling, an alpha over 4 pi times a log m pi over m mu. Sorry, over ME, this is now a pretty big log. It makes this rate, this ratio, the fraction of E nu decays that have a photon bigger than the fraction of mu nu decays that emit a photon. And that is something like a few times 10 to the minus 7. Okay. This is all we need to describe the vast majority of pion decays. Can't decay into anything else. It can't decay into, because there's basically no phase space for any other particles other than leptons, and we know their weak interactions exactly. We can do the same kind of calculation inverted to look at tau decays. You can look at leptonic tau decays. You can also look at tau decays to pi minus nu tau, or to k minus nu tau. The difference between these two, the only differences are the phase space, because of the masses of the two of these particles, and these VUSs. So this ratio is largely controlled by VUD over VUS. And one can, if you look, this is about 10%. This is about 0.6% of all tau decays. That ratio comes out to essentially, I'm sorry, these should be squared. Mod squared. That ratio comes out to be 0.05. Consistent with the Kibibo angle squared that we would have gotten from k on decays itself. So this model, combined with the weak interactions of the quarks, has all of a sudden predicted basically all the decays of the pions, even the rare ones, predicted the branching ratios of taus to different species. And if we worked harder, we could also get the ratio of tau to pi to say the muonic tau decays question. Thanks. Indeed, they should. If we measured the VUS by comparing k to mu nu over to the pi to mu nu, that would also I mean, this would have more factors of mk in it, but this can also be used to measure a VUS, which is also a VUS squared, which is also about 0.05. Okay, so all of this checks out. I should say quickly where this fails, because it doesn't work everywhere. It doesn't work for fully hadronic processes. Things like k naught to pi plus pi minus. This is a difficult calculation because there's QCD diagrams that involve, let me draw in this kaon in terms of some quarks. And then I want to think of my pions as coming off of a W. Okay, I could draw a quark line something like this. The problem is that here there's QCD corrections all the way between the W interaction scale and the meson scale. There's QCD diagrams that connect the incoming current to the outcoming current. So they're difficult to calculate hadronic uncertainties in this kind of decay. Really just that there's QCD corrections to the matrix elements. So these are difficult. And these simple estimates would be off by order one numbers. Another thing that screws up, well, it doesn't, it's not really a screw up, it's just missing. If you were to look at the neutral current part of this, you'd think just like pi plus can decay to muon in a neutrino, pi naught, well, it can't decay to mu plus mu minus, just because a mu plus mu minus pair is more massive than a pi naught, but it can decay to e plus e minus. And you calculate this rate, it has the same parametrics as that with the m electron squared. You can even keep track of all the weak Weinberg mixing angles terms and everything. What you find, but what you expect is that the width should be comparable to this partial width, the 10 to the minus 4 on the pi plus, which corresponds to a lifetime of about 10 to the minus 4 seconds for this decay. This is the first weak interaction decay of the pion that you would run into. If you actually look at what happens to pions, their lifetime is much shorter. It's about 10 to the minus 17 seconds. And in fact, even if I look at the partial width, to e plus e minus, that is a 10 to the minus 8 branching fraction. So that's still 10 to the 5 times too big to be a weak decay. So the weak interactions have nothing to do with how the pi naught decays. Turns out pi naught, you remember I drew this diagram in talking about why U1 axial wasn't a real symmetry of the Lagrangian. This diagram with my axial U1 current here. And then I talked about adding two strong interaction currents. It's like coupling it to two gluons. Well, I can also write down, and that this had a non-zero matrix element, I can also write down a similar diagram with two photons. This is controlled by the axial anomaly, QED. This is non-zero. And this allows a relatively fast, in other words, it's not suppressed by 1 over mw to the fourth, decay of the pi naught. And the leading e plus e minus diagram, this one, This one actually doesn't lift, but I will work on the other board instead. Sorry, I'll try to keep that. Try to keep that visible. So, were you just having trouble seeing the pie knot decay stuff? Okay. Yeah, behind the stupid podium. Sorry. So, the lifetime of the pie knot is 10 to the minus 17 seconds. And that mostly goes through this diagram to two photons, which was related to the axial anomaly I told you about earlier, except instead of coupling to the QCD currents, I'm coupling to QED, because that actually has a fit. It's a smaller diagram, but the QCD one doesn't have any vital states to connect to. Right? The lightest state from QCD is the pi naught and the pi plus or minus. So that doesn't let it decay. This one is the first one that lets it decay. The rate is not suppressed by 1 over the weak mass, W mass to the fourth. And that's why this lifetime is so much shorter than for all the other pions, which decay through weak interactions. The dominant piece of the E plus E minus is actually this two-loop diagram, where I just attach them, so an E plus E minus pair onto those two, make them virtual photons. This has a rate about 10 to the minus 8 relative to this. So this is a sector that one has, for which one has to understand the anomalies, not described by the weak interactions. But important fact to remember when looking at the pions. The other thing that would go in a complete discussion of, I kind of want to give you a quick overview of what things I'm leaving out in talking about pions and kaons that are really important so that you know. The other thing that I hope one of the later classes will get to, some of the consequences of, is that the kaon system is a very interesting system. We had the neutral kaons in particular. So we had K naught and K bar naught. They're both neutral. They have different quark contents, but they're both neutral. And you won't see these guys in the PDG. You don't see these guys in the PDG because there's nothing forbidding them from mixing. And in fact, they do mix. So the degrees of freedom that we actually talk about are called K naught long and K naught short, because one of them has a short lifetime and one of them has a long lifetime. And those are the actual observable physical degrees of freedom in the kaon system. These are approximate CP eigenstates, so there's very, very rich physics there that can be used for precision measurements even of physics beyond the standard model. Other than that, I've pretty much taught you everything that I should about kaons and pions, so let's stop there. This is just these are just the quark, you should think of this as a quark diagram, right? And these are just the quarks that, if you like, are constituents of the, so this is just an order one coefficient. You do still get a lot of alpha suppression from here, right? Because each of those vertices has an E. Then you have an extra loop up here. Each of these has an electromagnetic coupling. So the lifetime goes like alpha squared times a bunch of pi factors for the loop. But there's no G for me. Yeah, so EE, and then in the rate, I was swearing it. 1e would give us alpha. Yeah, 1e in the, so there's an e squared of the matrix element, and then you square that to get the lifetime, or the to get the width, it's an alpha squared. All right, we're running a little late, so if people have questions, you can just meet me outside.